U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Bill Barr faces Senate grilling on his nomination to be Attorney General of the United States. How well did he do? And the Democratic presidential field seems to be growing almost by the day. Who's in so far and what are they running on? So here to talk about that, I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal. Here to talk about that is my colleague Kim Strassel. Hello, Kim.
Hello.
And let's start with Bill Barr. Democrats threw just about everything they had at him, reprising his views on a variety of public questions, questioning whether or not he had a view of executive power that was too expansive and would somehow lead to the rise of authoritarianism under Donald Trump. A memo that he wrote to the Justice Department when he was in private life last year, raising questions about a theory of obstruction of justice if a president fires the FBI director, James Comey, or otherwise asks questions about certain Justice Department matters. Kim, the overall impression I had is that he handled himself very well there. Looked to be a man who would be independent. Wouldn't be easy for any president or Donald Trump to push around, certainly not cross any ethical lines. And I think he emerges from this looking pretty good.
What was great about watching him is that he's clearly just a no-nonsense guy. And also at a period of his life, I think he's 68, where he said, you know, he's not looking for any future political capital. And so he doesn't feel any need to be pushed around by anybody. And it was great to watch him because his answers were very forthright and direct in response to a lot of the hypotheticals that the Democrats threw at him. He referred a lot to Constitution and laws and kind of shut down a lot of those lines of questionings as a result. He said he would allow Mueller to continue with his probe. He was asked a lot of hypotheticals about actions that the president might take and how he would handle them. For instance, would it be a crime for the president to issue a pardon in return for someone not incriminating him? And he said, yes, that would likely be a crime. But he also pointed out that many of the hypotheticals that they were throwing at him about the president, they need to be viewed as a question first of whether or not the president was breaching his constitutional duties, meaning it wasn't necessarily a crime. It was something Congress would need to look at as an impeachment matter. So it was he responded on a basis of law. And as you said, I think he acquitted himself very well.
One of the more amusing episodes was when he was asked if the implication was that he had written that memo I referred to on the obstruction of justice theory. If he had done that as a kind of audition for to get the job of Attorney General after Jeff Sessions, because he did acknowledge that he had sent it to the White House Counsel's office as well as to people at the Justice Department, and I thought that was amusing because as if the next 2 years as Attorney General, if he's confirmed, are going to be a walk in the park, truly a joy for somebody who's already had the job, and as you say, is 68. I mean, it's not. It isn't any service that I would volunteer for, that's for sure.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people have been lining up for this position. I mean, goodness, look at how Jeff Sessions was treated for the last 2 years. So it certainly – the position doesn't recommend itself. But here's the good news is, you know, Bill Barr's been through this rodeo before. He's run the Justice Department. One thing that I found encouraging is that he seemed willing – all that being said, he seemed willing to go in there and also take a fresh look at what happened in 2016. He was asked by a number of senators if he would do that. And he was willing to do that. And we know that he has, from his last time as an attorney general, he looked at what he felt were breaches of duty within the Justice Department. The FBI actually had a role in what ultimately ended up becoming the only other firing of an FBI director, William Sessions at the time. And so he seems capable of stepping back and being just fair about looking at those questions of FBI and DOJ actions.
No matter what he does, he's going to be criticized by Democrats as partisan and as serving the interests of Donald Trump. And meanwhile, Donald Trump will along the way no doubt lambaste him for any disagreement that he might have with Bill Barr. And he just, you know, if Bill Barr does say, look, I'm not going to follow this particular policy. And if he resists him on anything, there's no question. He's going to get it from coming and going. So I don't think this is the kind of job many people are going to volunteer for. So Trump is lucky that Barr has stepped up here. One of the interesting things that some of the critics are making much of this morning is the fact that Barr said that the report that Robert Mueller eventually produces in his special counsel investigation may not automatically become public. They're saying, oh, that's somehow offensive. The public deserves to know this sort of thing. Well, look, he's a prosecutor, Mueller is, and the reports don't necessarily – I mean, the job of a prosecutor is supposed to indict or not. And you're not supposed to opine about, well, we came close, we had 50% proof or 60% proof, that's not really the job of a prosecutor. In this case, Mueller probably will provide a report. There's no mandate, command that has to be made public. Now, I think ultimately it will leak, even if it isn't released formally by the Justice Department, so probably the Justice Department should release it. And if nothing else, Democrats will subpoena it in the House, and then it will be made public. That's really much ado about nothing as criticism.
Barr was very clear, because he was asked this question several times, if he was going to make Mueller's final report available to the public. And his answer was consistent. He said, I'm going to make as much information available as I can. I'm going to be as transparent as I can, consistent with the rules and regulations that are part of the special counsel regulations, which I think is an important caveat, because even if he wanted to release it, there are, and I'm not exactly sure what those rules say, but there are some regulations and diktats about personal information, et cetera, and so on. So all of it may not be even if he wanted to, he might not be able to put it out, is what he was saying.
Well, you're not supposed to throw out innuendo, for example. I mean, that people might have committed crimes or not. I mean, they either committed them or they didn't.
This was the criticism of Jim Comey and his press conference about Hillary Clinton. Remember,
right? Yep.
You don't hold public forums like that where you say, yes, we did this whole investigation, and no, we're not indicting anyone, but here let me tell you about all the ways in which I think Hillary Clinton erred in judgment.
That was way over the line with Comey, and was a fireable offense in my view at the time. Loretta Lynch should have fired him, the attorney general then. Well, we're talking about Bill Barr, but we're going to talk about the Democratic presidential field when we come back. And you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel. And let's turn to the emerging Democratic field, which even this early in 2019, a year before the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primaries, is already emerging. And who knows, Kim, we might have a cast of thousands here. We've got Elizabeth Warren already, Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York. is now saying she'll run. Tulsi Gabbard, the Hawaii congresswoman, is going to run. Julian Castro, the former secretary of HUD and mayor of San Antonio, is out and running. And we have intimations about Joe Biden and Cory Booker and others, though they haven't made their formal announcement. I mean, we could easily have I think we'll easily have double-digit candidacies, and I wouldn't be surprised if we have upwards of 15, 16.
Oh, it's going to be fun. It's going to actually make the last Republican primary race, which was pretty crowded itself, it might make it look tiny by comparison. And we're probably going to be getting all of these names in the next month or so. And so then we'll have a pretty good idea of the field. Some people are waiting until what is a more traditional time to usually announce. I should note that some of these early people that have already thrown their hat in the ring, it's pretty early in the process to do it. Most people wait, they get the new year rolling, they go out and they do some groundwork, gauge things, but there has been an exceptional enthusiasm to be among the first.
It's interesting. Elizabeth Warren coming out, she's very much running as a economic populist on the left, a sort of Trumpian in her anger and populism, but with different, very different policies, claiming the economy's rigged and running from the left on that. Then you have Kirsten Gillibrand. She seems to want to be running as a sort of Hillary Clinton heir, as the spokeswoman for women, stressing her the Me Too movement and her fight against the fact that she got Al Franken, the former senator from Minnesota, to resign, was the first critic there. You have Julian Castro, who I think is running explicitly on his Mexican heritage, and a kind of trying to say, look, I'm optimistic like Barack Obama was. I want to bring us together. But by the way, don't forget that I'm Mexican American. and he's trying to become a spokesman for that portion of the Democratic electorate, clearly an ethnic identity that he wants to stress. And then Tulsi Gabbard, congresswoman from Hawaii, who was once fairly conservative on a lot of issues, now very much a isolationist on the left in foreign policy, but also heterodox enough that she criticized Kamala Harris and Marie Hirono, the senators who attacked the a judicial nominee for belonging to the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic men's group. So this is already emerging with different candidates trying to pick to stress different elements of either their biography or their ideology.
And it's notable how what they're stressing has often been, at least to me, an attempt to try to protect them or shore them up against some of the main criticism that they feel that they're going to be getting when they go out there. So, for instance, you know, Kamala Harris has been out. She has not officially announced yet, but it looks pretty clear that she's going to run. And she's been talking about all of the work that she has done over the years for minorities and racial justice. And this is because she has already been getting some flack from progressives about the fact that she was the Attorney General of California. And they feel that she, in that time, as basically a prosecutor, was too tough on a lot of the people that ended up going to jail there and minority defendants, et cetera. So she's out there talking a lot about how, in fact, she was a progressive prosecutor who was shining light on injustice. So this is going to be a big thing that she's talking about while she's out there. Kirsten Gillibrand has already been under a lot of complaints that she began her career as a supporter of gun rights. She was opposed to gay marriage. So she has moved very much left and is positioning herself as a protector of mothers and a spokesperson for women, specifically against those issues, which, you know, she talks now a lot about gun control and the need of making communities more safe. Warren, Elizabeth Warren, one of her biggest concerns is that she's viewed as a little bit old news in the face of a lot of these newcomers. People felt she might have had her chance 2 years ago. And so this is why we see her announcement videos trying to get down with the youth and drink a beer on camera. So it's been fun watching them come out because they're almost broadcasting the concerns that they have in this new wacky world of Democratic and identity politics of how they're trying to navigate those minefields.
Yeah, the challenge for each of these candidates is to first, I think, nail down sort of the core group of support, and then suggest to donors and small and large that they're a serious enough candidate with enough a chance of winning to start to attract money and support and campaign help, especially in the crucial early states, and then fashion a message which is somewhat broader than that early support group. And it's going to be interesting to see with a fragmented field just how candidates can do that. Among the early candidates we've mentioned already, I'd say that Elizabeth Warren is probably the most formidable right now, the biggest, has the best chance of being a long distance runner. But as we know so well from 2016, you rule people out at your peril as a political analyst. Donald Trump would not have been anybody's suggestion for getting the Republican nomination. In 2016, in January of 2 years earlier, 2014, so, well, 2015, but there he is in the White House. So I think any of these people possibly could catch fire if they get the right message and their personality appeals to elements of the Democratic primary electorate. The other point I would make, Kim, is that what this growing field shows is that the Democrats really think they're going to win. They think this job is whoever gets the nomination is going to beat Donald Trump. It's really a nomination worth having. And so everybody is going to go for it. And this is their chance. And that's why the field is going to be so large. There have been years, presidential election years, when the field was much, much smaller. I can remember 1992. Bill Clinton wasn't really in the race even in August yet of 1992. And no Democrats really wanted to run against H.W. And of course, Clinton ended up winning.
Well, you're absolutely right that the Democrats, they're viewing this primary, in essence, as a presidential race because they're so convinced that they're going to beat Donald Trump. So whichever them, they feel whoever comes out of this on top will be the next president. So it's going to be a very hard-fought primary, too, which I'd like to just point out also comes at a fragile time in the Democratic Party, which is experiencing its own version or beginning to of some of the conflict and divisions that Republicans had 8 years ago or so when the Tea Party really emerged, and big challenges from the progressive left versus moderates. There's not always a lot of unity there and a lot of different views. I also agree with you that we can't count any of these people out, nor can we look at the front runners and think that that means anything. I remember 3 or 4 years ago when everybody believed that Jeb Bush was going to be the next president, and look how that went. You mentioned Elizabeth Warren. One thing just to point out, she has been very, very savvy in one regard in particular. She came out first and she kind of set a line for all of her competitors and said, we cannot be the party of big money, of corporate donors, of billionaire candidates. She already, as a result, successfully convinced Tom Steyer, one of said billionaires, not to run in the race because he knew she was going to and other candidates would beat him and his self-funding over his head. We'll see whether or not that also discourages Michael Bloomberg from running. But she's put the rest of her colleagues in a little bit of a bind. Folks like Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, they've been very much counting on raising a lot of money, as you said, from these big donors, the corporate field, financial backers, Silicon Valley, and they're all having to make tough decisions right now if they're going to do that, and could make things a little tougher for them on the financial front in what is going to be a competitive race.
Yeah, if you're one of these people with relatively low name recognition, you're going to have to break through on the grassroots front. funding level. You're going to have to get small donors to give to you the way Beto O'Rourke did, for example, against Ted Cruz for the Senate race. You're going to have to do what Bernie Sanders did in the 2016 nomination fight with Hillary Clinton. And we'll see if any of those can break through, which is why getting out early, they think, is important. And also, we'll see if they can get a message that somehow sticks. All right. Well, hope too many viewers weren't offended by us talking about the presidential race so early, but it's really getting out there fast. So thank you all for listening. Thanks, Kim. And we'll be back later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.